Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hey, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and this is a special bonus episode. My original plan was to speak with producer Tom Werman about the work he did with Motley Crue. He produced Shout at the Devil, Theater of Pain, and Girls, Girls, Girls. And my original plan was to edit clips from this interview into those episodes. But that turned out to be too problematic, so I decided to just release my conversation with Tom Werman as a special bonus episode in the Motley Crue series. So Tom has been interviewed many times before, and he doesn't necessarily remember a ton of specific details. He produced a lot of records in those years, and so I think a lot of it's just a blur for him now. But we had a fun conversation about what he does remember about working with Motley Crue, so that's what this episode is. Special bonus episode in the Motley Crue series, my conversation with Tom Werman.
So long ago. I'll do my best, but there's not a lot of sensationalism.
No, yeah.
You know, it's more, you know, there. I just have a few insights and a few opinions, and, you know, that's all.
No, that would be great. Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate you talking to me.
Sure.
You came on at Elektra as head of A&R, like not long after they were signed. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had made their first album, then were signed on the basis of that album by Tom Zutaut, who had worked in the plant, I think, for Elektra, and then came on as an A&R guy. And he worked for me when I, you know, he became like one of my staff of two when, not including me. You know, when I started there. So he signed them, and I didn't get along. I was hired by Joe Smith, who is a wonderful guy, and then I couldn't deal with his replacement, whose name was Bob Krasnow, because Bob wanted to be the head of A&R as well as the head of the company. So I left. And they asked me to make a 3-album production deal on my way out. I got a nice little severance and also, you know, a certain amount per album for 3 albums. And Motley was the first, no, the second album. I think Dokken was the first. But anyway, it was Shout at the Devil. They came in to my office for a meeting. And out of that meeting, we decided that I should do the, that I would do the record. So that was it.
Okay, so it was just kind of part of a deal that you made with Elektra that you had to produce something, and it ended up being Motley Crue?
Right. That was the first of the three. And it was, yeah, it wasn't a comfortable meeting that we had, because they didn't have a lot of trust in people. They had a bad experience with their first manager, really bad, I guess. And they had a general mistrust of suits, you know, and
yeah,
labels and
yeah,
the corporate deal. And Tommy, fortunately, at a certain point, said, "Listen, guys, if we're considering having this guy produce our album, then I think we should listen to him." And that was great. I was really grateful for him doing that, because it you know, they were pretty guarded. So that was the beginning.
Well, and I know that they were big Cheap Trick fans, so you'd think that they would at least, if they knew that you had produced Cheap Trick, you'd think that would have been kind of a plus for them to have you, to work with you.
Yeah, it could be. They might have thought that Cheap Trick was more of a power pop band, you know, than necessarily a hard rock band.
Yeah.
Especially from my records, which tend to be a little poppy.
Yeah.
Which is why Motley, I think we did well together, Motley Crue and I, because they were very aggressive and hard live, and I kind of commercialized it. That's all. You know, I was pop. They were rock.
Yeah. Well, I would say in terms of the songwriting, just the melodies and the pop sensibilities, Too Fast for Love is a poppier album than Shout at the Devil, because Shout at the Devil just goes a little bit more in the heavy metal direction, but that probably just comes down to that's the kind of songs that Nicky was writing, right?
Well, you know, I think I didn't have as much to do with Shout at the Devil. It was more a transfer from, you know, live to tape.
Yeah.
Without too much fooling around and experimenting and arranging, you know, and production generally. I mean, it was a faithful, more faithful translation of the band's live performance than was Girls, 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 where I really got into it. And of course, you can tell the difference just from the sound. I mean, if you listen to the song "Shout at the Devil" and then you listen to the song "Girls, Girls, Girls" or "Wild Side," big difference.
Yeah, true.
Big difference. And so, you know, because they were, man, you know, the "Girls, Girls, Girls" record was kind of, you know, much more, I think, much more commercial and designed to be heard on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I tried to do for my bands. Get them on the radio. And the bands didn't necessarily understand or appreciate the fact that if you made a top 10 single, it would be, you know, it was responsible for selling over 1 million albums.
Right.
Just by itself. So the band could have been successful, you know, already, and maybe had a base of 750,000 albums or maybe 1 million albums. But the top 10 single, their first one, would have, you know, would be responsible for another 2 million albums. Sometimes they, you know, that happens. They're delighted. They buy new houses, new cars, and then they accuse you of not making a record that was hard enough. Because if you did make a record that was hard enough, it wouldn't have gotten on AM radio. So, you know, you're damned both ways.
Well, and then they were so unhappy with what you did that they made two more records with you. That's
yeah, right. That's right. So we did have a good relationship, because I basically let them be, you know, who they wanted to be, and I worked with their limits, their limitations. Like, you know, Tommy and Mick were wonderful in the studio, so easy, so productive. Nicky was the brains behind the outfit, and he was extremely. He was extremely productive too. He improved quite a bit as a bass player, you know, over the time I was with them. There was like 5 years. Vince, you know, he's a famous party guy. He loved to party, but he was a hard, you know, I would not make a big deal if Vince came in and spent a few hours in front of the microphone singing, and we only got a couple of lines that day.
Yeah.
You know, I that was okay. He's Vince. So, you know, that was what I consider working with a band within its limitations, and not saying, geez, would you get it together? Or please don't go out and party tonight. We've got an important day. We got to finish these vocals this week. Or let's get some other guy in here to sing. Something like that, you know. So that was the deal. You know, you let each guy contribute to the album the way he wants to and the way he's capable of doing. And, you know, I mean, Nicky just, you know, crashed his car into a telephone pole, and Vince was drunk driving and all that stuff. And you know, it was part of the program for me. I viewed it as, all right, that's who Motley Crue is, you know, and we worked around it.
And it seems like the prevalence of drugs probably got worse and worse the longer you worked with them, right?
I think it reached its height from what I saw during Theater of Pain, which was a really difficult album for all of us. That's when I think the heroin made its debut. I didn't realize that they were actually using until, and I think it was just mainly Nicky, maybe Tommy a little bit, until Girls, Girls, Girls. It was tough. But right after Girls, I think they cleaned up.
Yeah.
I know they cleaned up when they went to Vancouver and worked with Bob Rock. They were like a vegetarian SWAT team. They were, you know, they were working out and they were eating right and they were doing, and you could hear it. Now you could hear it in Kickstart My Heart. A lot of energy, a lot of real tight, great song, great album he made with them. But I kind of regretted that they were so unhealthy when I worked with them, because it was, I think, a bit more of a challenge.
Well, my impression of Theater of Pain, tell me if I'm right or wrong, but my impression is that record was made by a band that showed up at the studio with almost nothing prepared and then just had to write and piece together songs as they recorded the album. Is that
accurate? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was with a lot of bands in the 70s and 80s. They would kind of be caught off guard by a surprise smash album like Shout at the Devil, which took off and really exploded in terms of sales.
Right.
And so what does the record company do? They say, we need you to get back in the studio right away, and then we'll, you know, we'll work with an agency and book a big tour. We'll have a record to support the tour and everybody will make a ton of money. So you've got this much time. Meanwhile, Nicky and Tommy have been writing for years, and they put a lot of good songs on the first album, which I consider Shout to be the first album.
And then
all of a sudden, bang, you have to write 12 good songs from right when you get off the road. You know, maybe you've got 6 weeks, maybe you got 2 months. You have to make an album, you have to write the material, you have to record it, you know, and then you have to go out on the road again. So it is tough, really tough, especially from the writer's point of view. And I think that they seek relief with self-medication, you know. It's too much pressure.
Well, just listening to the records, the songwriting on Shout at the Devil is really strong, and then it just plummets to the songwriting on Theater of Pain. To me, is really weak. Like, almost there's very little there that's any good at all. And especially if you compare it to Shout at the Devil, it's just...
Yeah, I can't remember. You know, I should have looked at the track lists before I talked to you, but... weren't there a couple of hits?
Well, of course.
Home Sweet Home?
Yeah, of course, Home Sweet Home is a really well-written song, but that's it. That's, you know, and then really, the other hit was a cover, Smokin' in the Boys' Room, so.
Oh, yeah, Smokin', right. Good.
But then if you look at the rest of the original material on that record, to me, I don't like any of it. It's crazy that there's just very little there worthwhile.
Sure, that could be.
And I mean, yeah, obviously that has nothing to do with you. You just have to work with what they give you, right?
Well, I have to do my best with it.
Yeah.
You know, the producer at that point, they were so distracted by fun and games that I had an opportunity to, you know, to do some arranging, to do a little production work. So, you know, I was responsible for improving the songs as much as
yeah, right,
they were capable of being improved upon.
Well, like how long would that have, would you have spent in this studio to make that record about? Would it have been months or?
I think probably about 2 months.
2 months, yeah.
Yeah. And that would have been fast.
Yeah.
Probably 10, I would say 10 weeks. That was the average in those days.
If you've got Nikki Sixx on heroin trying to write an album while you're recording it, I can't imagine, you know, I think that's why you end up with a record like Theater of Pain, because it's just...
Could be.
Yeah.
It could be. But he was pretty productive and pretty smart.
Yeah. He's a great songwriter, but know, it seems like he's not... He definitely wasn't as disciplined or, you know, he had to really put his mind to it and, you know, not be lazy or distracted or...
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. He definitely produced, you know, his best work when he felt like it.
Yeah, right.
You know, he didn't say, well, I got to sit down and write a song now. He, you know, waited for inspiration, and some of the inspiration was drug-fueled. So,
well, Nikki even says in their book, he says that if he hadn't written Wild Side and Girls, 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 he thinks that record would have been the end of their career. He just feels lucky that he actually had a couple of decent songs. So,
yeah, which book was this?
The Dirt.
The Dirt?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I got to say, we went over and over. Nikki and I went back and forth online about this. There's in both books, Heroin Diaries and The Dirt, I don't remember things the way he does.
Yeah,
it's that simple, and that's all I'll say.
Well, in my opinion, The Dirt is probably 75% fiction. That's my impression of it.
I skim through and try to read the parts that have to deal with me, so I can see how much bad stuff, you know, it was said about me.
There wasn't much. There's one part where they Nikki says that you were writing notes in the studio, and then when they looked at him, it said mow the lawn and buy ballet slippers or something like that.
Ballet slippers, right?
Yeah.
Right. That I had a book. I did have a book.
Yeah.
And I may have written notes in it that, you know, personal notes about stuff that I had to do. I wouldn't write mow the lawn.
Yeah.
You know. None of my kids ever took ballet. So, you know, so much for that.
Right.
You know, I didn't mow the lawn. We had a gardener, and the lawn wasn't that big.
Right.
You know? So I knew where that came from. But it's really too bad that bands, you know, kind of throw you under the bus after you're not useful to them anymore. You know, I made three really good, I think, you know, very successful records with them. They got very rich and built a huge career with those three records. And when they decided not to use me and they went to work with Bob Rock, when they had the record release party, they didn't even invite me.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, it was like 5 miles from my house.
Yeah.
And they didn't bother. It was like, oh, yeah, well, you're of no use to me anymore, so basically you don't exist. And it's really a drag. It's indicative of not who they are, but, you know, it's all about them. And there are very few lasting relationships, I think, between producers and their big hit acts. I still keep in touch with a lot of the guys and gals that didn't make it that I worked with.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, maybe there's an element of that they want all the credit and they don't want to they don't want you to get the credit for their success. They want to keep it all for themselves.
That is definitely something I truly believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And except for people like, believe it or not, Ted Nugent, who, you know, suffers from a real bad rap from what he says.
Yeah.
And I agree. I mean, he went off the rails somewhere, and I'm at the opposite end of the political spectrum from Ted. But believe it or not, he has more integrity than almost any other artist I work with. He always has nice things to say. You know, he gives credit where credit is due. He speaks the truth, except when it comes to politics.
Yeah. Well, as an example of why Motley Crue should be indebted to you, or, you know, appreciative of your work, is the, from what I understand, you had to piece Vince Neil's vocals together, like word by word, practically, right?
Sometimes, you would do, I don't know if, I think that there was one day when he was in for the entire afternoon and we kept one line.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, you know, that's an exhausting day for everybody. But yeah, I had this procedure that I used to use with vocals that was designed to not wear out the vocalist. So I'd do three tracks, three performances, and then put them all together, line by line, half line by line, word by word, whatever it took. And I'd create one pretty good track, and then we'd do two more. And I'd do the same thing. And by then, it was almost perfect. So that what it means is that he had sung the song five times. And by the end of that time, I would have put together something that needed only maybe a word or two in each verse that we would use. So I'd just go in and punch it in. But there are times when, you know, like that one line day, Vince was, you know, he was hungover, he was, you know, not in good shape. And so nothing he sang really was acceptable. There just wasn't enough to put together.
Yeah.
So we called it a day, and, you know, that was that. That's why budgets went out of control.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
The studios made a lot of money, huh?
studios did make a lot of money, but you would try to choose the right studio for each phase of the album. And you'd get a big room that cost like $3,000 a day to do your tracking, your basic tracks. And then as soon as they were done, you'd move to a much smaller studio, you know, and then you'd do one instrument at a time. You know, you do guitar overdubs, you do vocals, you do whatever. And then you go to a mix room. So
was it a much bigger challenge with Vince Neil to get a quality vocal track than other people you worked with? Or did your same process generally work with him as well?
I think Vince was probably, took the longest. Robin Zander was lightning fast.
Right. Yeah.
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 And that was the biggest difference, I think, Vince and Robin. But, you know, Vince, he was the front man. He made, he was right for that band.
Yeah, it's true.
Especially live.
Yeah. And what was Mick Mars like? Because he was significantly older than the other guys, and he had a much longer career playing lots of different kinds of music. And then he ends up in this heavy metal band, which it seems like it was just an odd place for him to end up in his career. But
it was, but his, you know, he was perfect for them.
Yeah.
He was extremely well prepared, extremely well prepared. He had great licks. I mean, he just had hook after hook after hook that he played. And it was the basis for all of their songs, really. But it was really drums and rhythm guitar, Motley Crue, in terms of the track, the musical track. He would come in, he would cooperate. He was never in bad shape. If he was, it was because of legitimate physical issues, not drugs.
Yeah.
The only time that, you know, that I had to really help him out was with guitar fills, not solos, not rhythm tracks. Guitar fills, like, you know, you get to the end of a chorus and there's something, you know, there's music until the beginning of the next verse.
Right.
There's something in there or between lines. And I'd suggest stuff to him. I'd say, why don't you, you know, play something like, you know, and we'd work on it and we'd put fills in where they really belonged. And it was great. It was great. So he was really easy to work with and very underrated, I think, as a guitar player. Had some great solos.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
So when it says that Nikki Sixx wrote a song, is that where he's got just a very basic, maybe even a bass part, and then Mick Mars takes that and really turns it into a cool guitar lick and a cool riff?
You know, I don't know how that really happened because the songs were pretty much formed by the time we got to rehearsal. And I didn't do, I tried not to do too much rehearsing because you just rehearse the life out of a song. I still wanted some spontaneity in the studio. I think they got it together as a group, the three of them. I think Vince came in later and Nikki told him what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think when Vince showed up for Theater of Pain, that was right after he had been in jail because of that drunk driving accident. And
It was hard times.
Yeah.
Hard times.
And then...
And that's when Tommy started dating celebrities.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then Theater of Pain was somehow such a huge success that when they come to make Girls, 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 you know, is that a lot of pressure? At that point, you've got two really big albums, and now you don't want to blow it, right?
Well, every time you have a hit, it's more pressure.
Yeah.
Because you always, you know, personally speaking, I had a lot of hits, and every time I had a hit, it would make me uncomfortable because I'd say, oh, geez, now I have to do it again, and they're going to discover that I'm just an imposter. I really don't know what I'm doing. You know, that's the fear that you can have. So fear of failure, that happens. Yeah. I mean, Nikki must've felt a tremendous amount of pressure. I have no idea. I was around it a lot. I went out on the road with these guys sometimes and I would be on the stage, on the side of the stage, and I'd look at the audience, and I'd be backstage, and I'd see incredible pressure, time pressure, time binds. Come on, you have to do this. You're going to do that. You can't be with that girl now because you've got to get up and do a radio interview at 9 o'clock in the morning, I don't know. There, you've got to sign jerseys. You've got to do this. You got to sign albums. You got to be at an in-store. And then you've got to write 12 new songs. And you've got to play every day. And you've got to get on the bus. It's really tough if you're a big band. The deal is that Motley spent much of the time around Shout at the Devil and Theater of Pain being an up-and-coming band. I mean, they were famous, they were big, but they weren't the Stones, you know?
Yeah.
And the Stones, when they travel, it's like they're carried on pillows. I mean, they have people to do everything for them, everything. Motley didn't. I mean, they still had a bus, you know, not a plane yet. So, you know, after a while, then you get up to that level, it gets easier, but when you're on the way up, there's a tremendous amount of pressure. They didn't seem to mind, though.
Well, so do you have any specific like Motley Crue stories or memories that stand out to you that are interesting or funny or, you know, from that time period?
I actually, just right off the top of my head, no, there aren't any that I can really talk about.
Yeah.
there are a couple of X-rated ones. I don't know. I spent some time at Nicky's house in Sherman Oaks when he was with Vanity. And they were both doing drugs, and that for me, that was interesting, but it's not a story really.
Yeah.
I can't really, entertain you with any stories. I just remember scenes. I remember Doc McGee's wedding. I remember Vince and Charisse. I remember Tommy's bachelor party, Vince's bachelor party. it was fun. There was one time when the band, and it was Doc McGee's wedding reception, I think. It was at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills. And it was big, I don't know, Tommy and I were in the men's room. Sam Kinison came in, and he poured lines of cocaine out for everybody who was in the bathroom. And then he invited everybody to come over to the, the Comedy Store, was that it, on Sunset?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Where he took everybody from the wedding, it wasn't everybody, it was about 12 people from the wedding party. He was going to do a set, and first he took everybody out back and gave them more drugs. and then he did his set. That was a memorable thing. It wasn't particularly. It was because of the nature of Motley Crue. It didn't have anything to do with Doc, with their manager. But that's the kind of I'm sure that the stuff that they wrote about, that Nicky wrote about in the book. I'm sure the stuff that happened at their apartment when they were all living together, it happens. It was probably pretty real. I mean, the stuff that these bands did when they were just starting out and trying to be badass, more badass than the next band, like Guns N' Roses, you don't want to know what they did. It's really, 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 some places where I wouldn't go.
Yeah, especially in the Me Too era. It's
not really. But in those days, the women were not unwilling.
Yeah, right.
Especially the ones who frequented, who were hung out with bands like Motley and Guns N' Roses.
Well, and it's funny that, Motley Crue in the studio obviously were not satanic worshiping drug crazed party animals. They were probably just pretty professional and, serious about making a record.
Well, yes, they were. They had fun, but they worked.
Yeah.
Nobody really, really goofed off. I can't remember anybody worse, but but really they weren't all that bad.
Worse in terms of just kind of out of control and the drugs and
right.
Everything. Yeah.
Right. Unfocused.
Yeah.
But to be honest, producers are supposed to help the band realize its musical vision. But the fact is that I wasn't unhappy when the band was distracted because I could do what I wanted musically without interruption or contradiction. Normally you'd say, hey guys, I think we should do this, we should put an organ in this place, or we should harmonize here and let's try it, and you'd try it and they would either say yeah that's good or we don't like it, and I would always try to do it my way. But if it came down to yes or no, then hey, I'm the guy that they hired. It's their record, so they would win that argument. If they're distracted enough, they don't argue at all. They're not. You go ahead, do what you want. That sounds good. That's fine.
Right. So whose idea was it to do Helter Skelter? Do you remember?
Probably Nikki's.
Yeah.
I don't think I did that. I think maybe it was, I can't guarantee this, but I think I suggested smoking in the boys' room. But I didn't suggest, I don't think I suggested Helter Skelter.
I understand why they did it, especially in the 80s.
Oh, sure.
It had those Manson family connections and anything, but also, you know, it's not the greatest version of the song.
No.
Yeah.
But there you go. Yeah, that's why they did it. They liked that, you know, those were the days of the PMRC and backward masking and record burning. And
right. The satanic panic, yeah.
Devil worship, satanic, and they had that pentagram. And, you know, they liked that. It worked.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hilarious that the adults and the parents actually took it seriously and didn't realize that it was mainly that was the point of it, was to make them uncomfortable.
Well, and kids, well, you know, kids can be impressionable. So, you know, I wouldn't just laugh and, you know, have laughed and sent my kids off to a Motley Crue concert necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my kids grew up with, a lot of metal and a lot of rock and roll and a lot of studio and backstage and dressing room sometimes. And it just, they were exposed to so much of it that it meant nothing to them. You know, they kind of went the other way.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes that's good. You grow up in an environment, an environment that's full of stuff like that, but harmless. And they got it. So they, you know, they didn't do drugs. They didn't screw around.
Oh, I know one other thing I wanted to ask you about is that in the beginning intro on Shout at the Devil, who was the guy that voiced that, and how did that come about?
Nikki wrote it, and Jeff Workman, the engineer, he was a bad guy, but he was a very good engineer. He spoke it.
Oh, okay. So it was just the engineer doing, like, does he do like an accent? Was he trying to put on like an accent or something?
No, he's English.
Oh, he's English.
He was English. I think he died. I did a couple of records with him, but he was very divisive, very destructive. That was it. I mean, he did Shout, he did Stay Hungry, Twisted Sister. Those were the only two big ones.
So what was Nikki like, hey, you have an English accent, you just come read this. was that what it was, or?
I don't know. I don't know how it started. I don't know who suggested that.
Yeah.
But it was good.
Yeah, it's cool.
That was good.
Oh, it was just the engineer. Okay.
Yep. Yep. Cool. Yeah. So that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Tom, for taking the time.
Is that good? Is that's good? You got enough.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. I could pick your brain more, but I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Well, I don't know if I could answer too much more.
Yeah, right. You're not going to tell me the X-rated stuff, so.
Right. Well, there really wasn't that much because I wasn't around for that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, maybe you'd hang out for a half an hour after the session, but. I wouldn't hang out with Motley Crue. That's way deep partying beyond having, you know, relaxing after the session. I mean, they, you know, they were into serious hardcore stuff. So I wouldn't hang out. And Mick went home.
Right.
You know, that was it.
But I mean, when you finish up Theater of Pain, Are you feeling like this isn't really up to snuff, but we gotta, you know, this is what we have, this is what we have to turn into the label?
Yeah. I felt the way you did about the songs. I felt that there weren't that many great songs. I did think Home Sweet Home.
Oh yeah, that's a very strong song. And it was kind of unusual. Were you surprised that they came in with this kind of piano ballad like that?
No, Tommy was a good piano player.
Yeah, so he played it on the record?
I mean, for a drummer, he was a good... Oh, yeah, he played the piano.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I took a lot of liberties on that one with sweetening and arranging. And, you know, it was kind of like Every Rose Has Its Thorn. It was a very simple song. With Every Rose, it was a guitar, a country song. With Home Sweet Home, it was a piano. And then I threw everything but the kitchen sink into there. I mean, you know, you've got big strings and it's just very bombastic, a power ballad.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was good.
A dreamer, but my heart's of gold. I had to run away high so I wouldn't come home low. Just when things went right, it doesn't mean they were always wrong. Just take this song and you'll never be left all alone. Take me to your heart, fill me in your bones. Just one more night, and I'm coming on this long and winding road.
Oh, I'll be back.